Welcome, friends, to the third foot, your extra limb of heroic failure, which we bring to you each month thanks to our noble and indeed ignoble Patreon supporters. Now, most months, myself and Barry decide to go back over our back catalogue and look at a winner of the show, or maybe not a winner, who we feel we could talk about in more detail and get more gobbets of failure out of. However, for a change on the third foot this month, we've got a guest, someone who heard a previous episode, in this case the one about the world's worst historical film, and sent us an email along the lines of, I think you'll find you've missed out an enormous turkey, gentlemen. And I should point out that it is not a movie about the enormous turkey gentleman of Massachusetts. That is a
Attack of the 50-foot turkey.
Yeah, that's for our world's worst, or indeed world's best, B-movie for another day.
And an excellent Thanksgiving as well.
Yeah, yeah, that'll last you Thanksgiving for a decade.
Yeah.
So the other voice you can hear, you will no doubt know, is my co-host, Barry McStay. But we're going to get straight to it and welcome our guest. And they can basically let us know why we were so wrong to choose Braveheart. Before I said Braveheart, my brain was about to say Mel Gibson's Macbeth, which was going to be so wrong from so many angles.
I so want to see that.
Oh, God. Yeah, do you? It'd just be Lady Macbeth going, the Jews made me do it.
Who would his Lady Macbeth be?
What, Mel Gibson's Lady Macbeth?
Mel Gibson's Lady Macbeth. Who would you cast? If you had the deciding role in here, you're the Hollywood producer behind this.
Oh, God.
Who do you go? Who can match the stature of Gibson as Macbeth?
God, Patricia Arquette? I don't know.
Yes, there we go. I would definitely pay good money to see that. Anyway, we're not talking about what will obviously be an Oscar bait movie in about 2025 if Ben has his way.
A Razzie bait movie, but we're going to talk about the Razzie of Razzies today. And joining us all the way from Canada is an author who has spent 3 years researching and writing the tale that he's going to tell us about. It is a book that was published last year. The book is called Killing John Wayne, more of which in a bit, and it is a delight to welcome Ryan Utawilligan. Hello, Ryan.
Great. Hello. Thank you very much for having me on the show.
Now, Ryan, obviously, we're going to get to this choice of film as a terrible film, but historical films in general, did you have any other footnotes for us based on the episode?
There's a lot, especially from the era of movies that, you know, I cover in this book.
The Hollywood historical epic.
Yes, I describe a lot of movies from the 50s that are just failed, terrible biblical epics. And so I mentioned a few. There's one with Richard Burton. I think he's supposed to be playing a 15-year-old. And I think at that point, he's in his late 40s. So.
That, I want to see Richard Burton as one of the, like, you know, Greece, famously everyone is too old to be teenagers. I want Richard Burton in Greece as hello, fellow high schoolers.
Yes, there seemed to be no care whatsoever in early, mid-50s. You know, anyone could play anyone. So
it was very age-blind and race-blind casting before its time in many ways.
Absolutely. So if you do like those movies, and especially, like, there's a lot made by RKO at that time, like Son of Sinbad, and quite a few that were made for no reason whatsoever other than getting women to do sexy dances in the desert and trying to just exploit every kind of possible thing, whether it would be a crazy massive set or just, you know, history in general that people seemingly had no understanding back in the day.
Was it the case that, you know, if they had one big blockbuster, had built an enormous palace for a set, did they go, well, we'll make five other films and make use of the set before we get rid of it? We've spent all the money on it. Is it that sort of thing?
Absolutely, yes. Yes. The big biblical epic from the late 40s called Samson and Delilah, that was sort of the big one that kicked it all off. And so everyone tried to copy it and do all these biblical epics, either about, you know, different chapters of the Bible or ancient Rome. And they're all filmed, you know, in the same areas of northern Morocco. There's a big film set there that just sort of has doubled for ancient Rome for a good 60 or 70 years. So, you know, if you've watched two or three of those movies, you've seen people just, you know, cross over the same spots, and they're supposed to be in different times, but after you watch them all together, at least you can definitely spot that it's the same.
We're gonna confuse a lot of archaeologists in the future when they discover lots of film cameras in an ancient Roman forum in northern Morocco at some
exactly.
point. Anyway, shall we get on to the book itself and the film in question?
Absolutely.
Tell us about The Conqueror and John Wayne's casting in it.
So that's the ultimate turkey. It is from 1956. And it's supposed to be about Genghis Khan. Now, not a lot was known about him in that time. Like, he was a known historical figure, but there wasn't tons of research. So they just kind of used it very lightly as this plot. It was originally written for a whole bunch of different actors, like Marlon Brando is going to play Genghis Khan. They tried to get Yul Brynner. They tried to get Robert Mitchum, and everyone started turning it down because the script was so bad.
I love that is the reason that all of these notably white Americans were turning down this script. I mean, I know it's too much to ask of a film from the 1950s not to dabble in yellow face, but oh my.
Well, yeah, well, all of those actors, that's the thing. They turned down this role, but they immediately went on to different roles where they played, you know, other ethnicities. Like Marlon Brando at the time, he played Mexican Emilio Zapata, like right before he did The Conqueror, and then he played a Japanese tea house owner right after. So for some reason, he didn't want to get the Mongol makeup. I don't know why he turned it down, but apparently he figured it wasn't for him.
None of them were turning it down on any ethical reasons. It was just the script was bad.
Exactly. It was this scriptwriter who had been nominated for an Oscar. He was named Oscar Millard, and he apparently he didn't even know who Genghis Khan was when he took the meeting to write the script. Right before the meeting, he got an encyclopedia and looked it up, and then that was his frame of reference. And so when writing the script, he wrote it in Shakespearean dialogue. Yeah, he didn't really do any research other than what he had done at the beginning with the encyclopedia and just kind of formed his own story. The actual genre that they classify it as is called a Chinese Western.
Yeah.
Managing to be both offensive to the notion of Westerns and indeed Chinese people. What with the fact that Genghis Khan, if I get my history right, A, very obviously wasn't Chinese, and B, if not him, then certainly his sons and grandsons really did fuck up the Chinese Empire quite a lot.
Yeah. They didn't understand any of that. And that was the thing with when John Wayne came around. He tried to play it with sincerity, and then he realized, this is a mistake. I can't really dive into this role, so I see Genghis Khan as a cowboy, as a gunfighter, so I'm just going to play him like I play all the rest of my roles.
John Wayne approaching acting the way John Wayne approaches every role John Wayne ever played.
The way John Wayne approaches every single thing. You mean I have to do some knitting? Sure, I'll approach it like a gunslinger.
He had the walk of someone who rides horses. The casting director went, Genghis Khan rides horses. Ergo, John Wayne is Genghis Khan.
The thing is, if you told me that there was a Hollywood movie where someone was playing Genghis Khan as a cowboy, I'd be like, and I presume written and directed by Mel Brooks.
I would watch that movie.
Of course you would.
That sounds fantastic. And yeah, they're unfortunately dead serious in this movie. And
the thing you said about him having just read an encyclopedia entry on his way to the meeting, it really shows. I read the Wikipedia, like, summary of the plot is quite short. Yes. And it's Mongol chief Temujin, which is the real name of Genghis Khan, falls for the daughter of a rival tribe's leader and steals her away, starting a war. And it's about this tussle over the woman who'd be his wife, which is basically like the first line in the biography of Genghis Khan. And this guy hasn't gone any further.
Exactly. There was no historical research. They didn't care. The reason why they John Wayne needed to make three movies with RKO Studios. So they made a terrible movie in 1949, 1950 called Jet Pilot, where he falls in love with a Russian spy who defects, basically. Mm. And then they made another one called Flying Leathernecks, which was a World War II movie. Both movies were bad, but not nearly as bad as this one. And it took about 3 years for him to find a suitable script for him to complete this contract that he had to do the three movies. Mm. So after they couldn't get Marlon Brando and Yul Brynner, they threw the script in the trash. And John Wayne came looking for a role to take a meeting to look for roles. The legend goes he did find this script in the trash bin, picked it up, flipped through it for a couple seconds, and said, well, how about this?
Wow.
So there's not much of a way that we can prove that, but so many accounts or people actually who's carried on this little legend, it seems like either it was in, you know, a trash barrel or some sort of a receptacle and he just picked it up. The fact is that he flipped through it for a second and like, yeah, this is the thing we're going to do.
We cannot prove that John Wayne is not part raccoon, and the evidence is growing stronger by the moment. RKO is, that's Howard Hughes' studio, right?
And it didn't start out that way. It started out as, you know, one of the big five Hollywood studios. You know, people tend to remember the globe with the little radio antenna on top. It sort of stands now as, you know, an emblem for classic film, but it was one of the biggest studios of the era. It produced King Kong. It produced some of the greatest movies of all time, like Citizen Kane and It's a Wonderful Life. But they were always kind of on shaky ground. And so by 1948, they were in a little bit of financial trouble and they sold the studio to Howard Hughes. And then he spent 6 years just running it into the ground.
Now, people will have seen The Aviator, and obviously there's a lot of the film stuff is early on, is sort of Wings era 20s and 30s film. Mm-hmm. Like at this point, it's post-war. Hughes is a bit older. Is he still on his wanting to make massive epics?
I find him to be just the most fascinating person of all time. And he started out in the early 30s making his big epics like Hell's Angels. And then he sort of went away from Hollywood for about 7 or 8 years. Then he made The Outlaw, this terrible Western that he just wanted to exploit Jane Russell's breasts. And then he flirted with the film industry for another 7 or 8 years. And then for whatever reason, I guess he just saw that he had this chance. And then he went full force into Hollywood. And I think he produced probably about 40 movies with RKO, and most of them are these big epics, and they kept getting bigger and bigger, but just worse and worse, because, you know, he didn't really have a vision. He just wanted to make money and exploit what he could.
I know there are quite a lot of elements of Howard Hughes that are quite problematic, but when comparing him to 21st century billionaires, he comes off quite sympathetically, I think. You guys might want to correct me, but I feel like if the current crop of men who have more money than sense instead just decided to treat Hollywood as their playground rather than, you know, far-right politics or the space race, the world might be a better place.
I don't know. I think if Howard Hughes was around today, he would also be trying to go to the moon in a penis-shaped rocket.
Absolutely. Yes, it just did. The world didn't offer him that at the moment, but he would absolutely be in space right now.
Going to the moon in a penis-shaped rocket is another cracking B-movie. Straight out of RKO.
I mean, most of what guided Howard Hughes was his penis. That was why he was making movies. He was exploiting young starlets. Like, he would contract 17-year-olds and promise them to be big, massive stars and never even put them in a movie. And he would even pay them. He would give them thousands of dollars just to be waiting for his call to say, okay, come on over, do your thing, and maybe I'll find a role for you. And he just kept doing that over and over again. And that's a lot of what historians think was his reason for even getting into the movie business and buying RKO, just so he had more grounds to be a predator.
I mean, looking at the poster for this film alone, you've got John Wayne looking very much like John Wayne at a costume party, actually. and then the actors is playing his wife is Susan Hayward.
Yes, correct.
In very like flowing flowing, lacy, non-13th century Mongolian traditional garb.
So Howard Hughes dated everyone in Hollywood, women, men, it didn't matter. And he apparently went on a date with Susan Hayward in the mid-40s, and it didn't go well. Apparently he went over, she cooked him a chicken, he didn't like chicken, and then she said he didn't want to see him again. And he resented that so much that he spent 10 years just waiting for the right moment to get his revenge. And so
now, guys,
another theory is that he made this movie just to make Susan Hayward look bad.
I have had some badly cooked chicken in my time.
And you're still working on that script for
Yeah, exactly. It's still pending.
The script is sort of banging around RKO, and John Wayne picks it up, and Howard Hughes greenlights it, presumably.
Yeah.
And then is it a long drawn out shoot process, or and sort of the references I've read seem to suggest it's quite a difficult shoot?
It's a difficult shoot, yes. The long drawn out part was finding this script. Once John Wayne said yes, and they had the director, they had everyone attached to it, that took a couple months. It was very quick. Mm. And then they were out, and it was 1954, so it took a couple of years for the movie to actually be released. But it was a rather quick shoot. It was a couple months just spent mostly in Utah. But it was very problematic, so it must have felt like a long shoot to the people there, because it was in the middle of summer, so you're dealing with in Fahrenheit it was over 100 degrees and windstorms and flash floods, and they're out in the middle of the Utah desert, so there's no shelter.
Are there difficulties with like equipment and the usual stuff you'd expect of filming in a desert in the 50s?
Absolutely. Like, they found this place which is now called Snow Canyon, and they couldn't even, they had to build a road to get to it. It was mostly just for keeping livestock, and so they built a road. They took over the town. It was only a few thousand people, and so all the stars were living in people's houses in this little St. George town. You had a bunch of fans running around, always kind of disturbing or trying to get autographs from the stars. And then you had Susan Hayward, who is struggling with alcohol addiction, who tried to start a affair with John Wayne on the set, apparently. And you had a lot of different accidents, like the co-star Pedro Armendariz. He fell off a horse and broke his jaw. Susan Hayward, they have a panther for, I think, a split second in the movie. So they brought a panther on set. And the panther apparently attacked Susan Hayward on the set.
Jesus Christ.
So just all these weird things that didn't, necessarily even have to happen in the movie.
Now, I've got to say, having pitched films to various people in my time, and occasionally you'll be told, this scene in the coffee shop, could that not also take place in the office where the majority of the actors have to save on the fee? I have never gone, I need a panther for 1 second in this film. And all of the attendant costs that'll come with it.
The animals really skyrocketed the budget here, because you had a panther, you had a bear. They like, just because they're this Mongol tribe, and so there's a very split second scene of this bear doing a dance. Like, I don't know what what the reason was, but they lead this little bear around to do a dance. There was a hawk that was supposed to sit on a guy's shoulder, and it took 3 days because the hawk was sick for whatever reason. So they postponed all shooting just to wait for the hawk to get better.
The hawk refusing to leave its Winnebago.
Exactly. Little diva.
That's amazing. I'm not going to get to the main problem with them shooting in St. George. Yeah. We'll sort of leave that for the moment.
Sure.
So they finish filming, and all of that happens fairly smoothly.
Somewhat smoothly. They looked at the dailies, and Howard Hughes said, I'm not happy with most of this. So they ended up doing a lot of reshoots in the studio in RKO in L.A.
Oh, wow.
And so what they did was truck tons of the sand from the desert all the way to the studio, just... And I don't know who would ever spot this, but just so, the sand matched the different shoots. So it looked like, the shots from the desert and the shots from inside the studio looked relatively similar, even though you can clearly tell it's a studio and watching the movie. I don't know why that was their concern.
Well, yeah, precisely. I like the thought the director thought that the real issue is there's going to be people watching this absolute car crash of a film going, hang on a minute, that's the wrong kind of sand.
Yeah, so that's the other thing too, is the director, he was this is a huge big budget movie, and the director was Dick Powell, and he had really no experience in directing a movie. He was a song and dance man in the 30s. He was in a lot of musicals, and then he played the Dashiell Hammond detective in one of the adaptations in the 1940s, and then he decided he wanted to direct movies. So he sort of went through all these different patterns, and so he was not in any way prepared to take on such a big monumental movie. So I think a lot of his decisions were also creating some problems.
Yeah, I mean, it's that, you know, John Wayne's an enormous ego. Mm-hmm. Howard Hughes is an enormous ego. Genghis Khan, albeit 700 years dead by that point, is an enormous ego. This is like this the size of the directorial hands required for this project are enormous. I don't know if anyone could do it. I mean, there are some movies from history that modern directors have looked back at and thought, I'm going to give this another crack of the whip. I don't think Peter Jackson is going to put down his pen from having edited 160 hours worth of Beatles audio and visual and thought, do you know what needs the treatment next? It's The Conqueror.
Agreed.
I like that Howard Hughes' attention to detail is at play here, because this is a couple of years. The film comes out a couple of years before sort of the bit everyone remembers from The Aviator, where he shuts himself away and watches movies over and over again. And this is one of the movies he continually watches as well, isn't it? The Conqueror.
Yes, exactly. It's a weird moment in history because, you see a lot of his younger days in the first half of The Aviator, and then it sort of jumps into...
Yeah.
Like, they move that around because The Aviator technically ends right before he takes over RKO. But that moment where he locks himself in the studio took place right after The Conqueror, because he was sort of dissatisfied with how it all went. He was losing so much money because of RKO, and eventually he just sold the studio, and then the studio couldn't manage and they went bankrupt.
Yeah. RKO closes the next year. Is that largely because of the
Conqueror? Yeah. He sold it in 1955. The only thing that they had left that they could really attempt to do is release this movie, and it didn't break even. And so they were left with no other choice. So they sold the studio, and then they closed the studio eventually. And Howard Hughes pretty much just dusted his hands and left Hollywood. And for the next just about 20 years, he starts slowly descending into insanity, living all around the world, living in Las Vegas casinos. And he chooses like three movies that he just continually rewatches. And this is one of them. Like he just asks his staff, play it again. And he would be, standing there naked in a room, just obsessed with it.
Were those sort of hints of mental health issues and his OCD already sort of evident?
Absolutely.
During this period,
beforehand? When you said earlier that he's somewhat of more of a sympathetic person, maybe, as opposed to what you see today, I think he did have these hints of mental health and OCD even before this. In the early 1940s is when it started surfacing, and he would find a stain on his shirt and take off his entire shirt in a restaurant bathroom just to clean it, and struggled with opening doors, and he wouldn't sleep regularly. He would sleep just in his office for an hour when he felt tired, and then he would continue on and work late at night, and then sleep for two or three more hours in the middle of the day. And he just continued this way of living for pretty much his entire life. And so there's just all these odd little hints, I guess, that ultimately came to a head. And he had so much money that no one ever questioned it or to help him. They just listened to him.
Yeah. So as you say, he sold the studio between the film finishing and it being released.
Yes.
And it's not received the most brilliantly by critics.
No, critics kind of roll their eyes. Why was John Wayne cast in this movie? But it does well at the box office. John Wayne obviously was at the peak of his career. This movie comes out right at the same time that The Searchers does, and people regard that as his best movie of all time.
Mm.
So it's a very odd comparison, but he Yeah, he managed to drive in the audience, and it was the 10th highest grossing movie of 1956.
Yeah.
But still, because it had such a big budget, it didn't even break even.
Yeah, that was what I was going to say. You can make a lot of money, but if you're already throwing a lot of money away shipping sand from the desert to Hollywood.
Exactly.
And the Panther budget alone.
Yeah, I could not find numbers on that one.
Yeah. I did read a few of the reviews for it. One of the ones I really liked was that you said the Shakespearean thing. I actually just noticed this is in iambic pentameter. It quotes a line from the film. It says, John Wayne is struggling with an unfortunate piece of casting and with such embarrassingly silly lines as, I feel this Tartar woman is for me.
Yes.
Which
yes,
you can't necessarily hear in his drawl without thinking that's hilarious.
Well, the thing too is before he did that, he tried a Mongolian accent, whatever it was, and I
no,
still,
really?
You know, I would love to hear that. There's oh, no dear. Recording of it, but still, yeah. he did give it the old college try.
Oh God, I'm sure it was very specific to a certain area of Mongolia as yes. well. He did his research. He did his yes. time with his dialect coach. I also like John McCartan in The New Yorker said it was pure Hollywood moonshine. You never saw so many horses fall down in your life.
Yeah, I love that review.
Yes,
and their tumbling is far superior to the antics of the actors. But the main problem is, that you've sort of we've glossed over is the location.
Mm-hmm. Yes, there's so much to this movie. Like it bankrupted a massive studio, and it made everyone just miserable because of the problematic shoot. But this is sort of what catapults it into a legendary myth, I suppose. They shot it in St. George, Utah, which was 137 miles downwind from a nuclear test site.
Appropriately, you have dropped that information like a bomb.
Yeah. If listeners didn't know this story and were waiting for the big twist, I don't know how many of you expected that as the big twist. 220 quick film crew members, and over 40% of them developed cancer during their lifetime.
Exactly.
Which is, you know, fairly average for you know, one in two people get cancer in life. But it's the fact that so many of them got it at a younger than average age.
Absolutely. And, you know, it happened, you know, a few years afterwards, like the director, Dick Powell, he was one of the first ones to die of cancer. And he was very young. I think he was in his early 50s at that point. And then co-star Pedro Armendariz, and then it just kind of took off at rapid speed. And John Wayne had lung cancer and beat that. But then he would die about 10, 15 years after that. Pretty much all the principal cast that we've been talking about, they all died in very terrible, cancer-stricken ways. A lot of the crew members and small bit part players did. And then, like, the movie is huge. They had thousands of extras who were of the local native tribes, and they paid them cents just to be there. And we'll never know how many of them, you know, just for being in that area, got cancer and died as well. Those numbers aren't included.
Yeah, of course. I mean, John Wayne, in fairness, was a six-pack-a-day cigarette smoker, so his lung cancer has... But equally, Agnes Moorehead was a non-smoker and teetotaler and fitness fanatic, she was also in the film. She died of cancer, so...
Yes, she was one of the first ones to kind of... Her dying words, I shouldn't have done this movie. She bought into it and
really?
Sort of... I think friends started to say, you know, I think there was some sort of nuclear contamination, and she...
Yeah.
She agreed.
Her mum blamed the film for killing her.
Yes.
Apparently. Yeah. And the John Wayne had two of his sons came and appeared in the film, and they both had cancers in their lifetime
exactly.
as well as a result. Oh, wow. But Howard Hughes felt guilty about this, didn't he?
Well, yeah.
Apparently.
The speculative thing, because they found out when they started shooting the movie that it was downwind from a nuclear test site. And so they asked Howard, is this safe? And he phoned up the Atomic Energy Commission. They said it was safe. So he didn't really bat an eye. He just said, yeah, it's fine. And let everything go ahead. And then right after the movie came out and RKO went bankrupt, he bought every single copy of The Conqueror. He bought it all up. And a lot of people have thought that it was his guiltiness. I personally think it was just he he liked this movie. He wanted it all for himself. But a lot of people have attributed that to him being embarrassed. And he later did say that he felt guilty as hell about the whole thing. But he never really commented more on that. He did a few, in the late 60s, he was trying to bribe Richard Nixon and the different presidents of the time to stop nuclear testing because he liked being in Las Vegas and he wanted Nevada to be pristine. And so he was trying to stop nuclear testing from happening. And we don't know, maybe that's something that led into it. But yeah, we don't exactly know if he directly felt guilty or not. It's sort of a gray area.
Why do you think he just liked the movie? Why do you sort of fall on that side of the debate?
That is one thing that we know that he said is he thought when making it was his masterpiece. He he was very excited because it sort of was a throwback to when he started, to with all the big giant epics that he wanted to make, and it felt like the big grand finale to his career, or it felt like the centerpiece. And I think ultimately he was satisfied with it. I think he did really like the movie just based on the manliness of it. You know, he apparently there's so many different stories of him being a closeted homosexual, and he was a very infatuated with John Wayne's performance. At least that's what people have said in his later years, and why he was watching it on repeat. God really only knows why he liked it, but I think he did. I think he was proud of it.
Yeah, he said he brought up every copy of the film,
yes,
just to keep it out of circulation,
yes,
and keep it for himself. But then Universal bought the rights to it after he died, didn't they?
Yeah, so 70s. It was out of circulation for over 20 years. Like no one ever saw it. There was a couple people who either got a hold of a rogue copy or claimed that they did, and then Howard either bribed them or, you know, did some sort of legal footwork and prevented it from being shown. So it disappeared, yeah. And then Universal snapped it up in the early 80s, and people started to see it again. And with movie rental stores coming at the same time, it sort of got a new life on VHS.
Yeah, it won a Golden Turkey Award in a book by Michael Medved and Harry Medved, film critic. And it's also John Wilson, who founded the Razzies,
yes,
listed as one of the 100 most enjoyably bad movies ever made as well. So
exactly.
It gets that kitsch, no publicity is bad publicity sort of thing, from being listed in all of these terrible film lists.
Exactly. And then even when the film started to be released more and more on VHS and DVD, they would be marketed as that. It's either a tagline that would say John Wayne's most unusual role, or it would even play into the whole nuclear contamination story. So
unusual role is, yes, putting it mildly.
It's doing a lot of heavy lifting, that phrase, isn't it?
What did John Wayne ever say? Did he ever say anything about the film? Did he avoid questions about it?
He did. Apparently he would shudder when people asked him about it. And he would even say, like, oh, there are some roles that you're not suited for, and this is one of them. And I don't think he ever watched it again. I don't think he was one for nostalgia anyways, but he definitely was embarrassed by it. And when people brought it up, he would either try and change the subject or to say, yeah, I was bad, bad, bad in that movie. And
there's a level of self-awareness late in the day, I guess.
Some self-awareness is better than no self-awareness, even when it comes to John Wayne.
I'm sad we didn't include it in the original podcast recording, but also glad that we didn't, because it meant we got to dive as deeply into it as we have with you, but obviously not deep enough. If people want to get a hold of the book, where can they get
a
hold of your book?
Purchase it anywhere, you know, wherever books are sold. You can, it'll be in some bookstores. You can order it online. If you use Amazon, you can get it that way. But yeah, it's Killing John Wayne, The Making of the Conqueror. And there's so much to it. That's the whole nuclear history is what I didn't know much about. I am not a nuclear physicist at all, but, you know, learning about the atomic history and how Americans were reacting to, quote unquote, history unfold, people would be encouraged to go and watch the nuclear bombs be detonated in the nuclear proving grounds. And You know, people would go to Las Vegas just to feel the rumble of the nuclear tests. So there's a really, you know, whole different side that we haven't really even talked about, just of nuclear atomic energy in the culture at the time. So there's a lot of different layers.
We always think about nuclear energy and nuclear bombs being part of the culture in a scary hide under your desk in class way, but we forget that both in America and I imagine Soviet Russia, it was lionized and encouraged and something to be proud of. We're a nuclear nation and that's a good thing.
It was the most modern, forward-thinking, like gung-ho edge of science thing. Like we've talked in the past about the world's worst toys and like being able to get toys that had literally bits of nuclear radiation.
Oh, exactly. It's because
you could pretend to be a nuclear scientist with your very own little reactor and things like that.
That's the thing with this movie is, you know, it charts that whole change, because it starts out that way, and then through the 50s and 60s people started to get sick. They're called the downwinders, and exactly what happened to the Conqueror crew, but no one paid any attention to them whatsoever until John Wayne died and people started to look at this movie in a different light and sort of piece things together. And that's ultimately how a lot of people who lived in the nuclear testing area got attention and got an apology and reparations from the government.
What we really need as the coda to this film is, and I've been banging the B-movie drum a lot, but a B-movie in which a nuclear John Wayne playing Genghis Khan returns, but he is 100 foot high. Attack of the 100 foot Temujin, I think, would sell so well.
You'd be crucified for that one now, I'm sure. But
as Ryan says, get a hold of the book wherever you can. You can also visit Ryan's website, RyanUtewilliganAuthor.com, where you can check out him writing on other film stuff from John Hughes to Harold Ramis and non-film stuff like Red Pandas.
Adorable.
Thanks very much for joining us, Ryan. Thanks to our Patreon donors for making this special episode possible. And thanks to everyone as ever for listening. We'll be back in a few days with a regular episode. Meantime, I think I know what we're going to watch for our next film night, Ben.
Enjoy. Don't say I didn't warn you.
Yeah.
That feels like what should really have been said before Robert Oppenheimer detonated the first nuclear bomb.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.